If you're enjoying this independent podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you could take a few moments to do a review, like, share and subscribe. And if you'd like to see extra content and show your support, head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. People are not all good, nor are they all bad. This is something Sam Vaknin says regularly, and it's true. But there are some who have more evil intent than good. They choose to harm others, and he's one of them. It would be easy for me to just focus on the acts of abuse and cruelty, which you've yet to hear the full account of from Anne. But in order to understand why his intended targets were successfully lured into his trap, it's important to understand the facade, the illusion, the mask that was so inviting. His account of his childhood is part of that. He was recognised as a child genius and became famous in his home country, Israel. But at home he was abused, and a warning, he does discuss this. It's impossible for me to fact check any of this, but he has spoken about it on camera before, and all his victims were told this tale during his storytelling dinners.
So between the ages of 0 and 4, I had been put on a pedestal, I'd been idolised, I've been cherished and admired and adulated, and I hesitate to say the word loved, because I'd been instrumentalized. I'd been put on display, especially by my mother. The whole neighborhood was coming every day. I would read the daily paper, the equivalent of Financial Times, let's say, or Wall Street Journal. So I was 4 years old and I was reading the daily paper, and everyone was standing around me. My proud grandfather, maternal grandfather, my mother, and so on and so forth. Teachers, I became the neighborhood attraction, and I was 4 years old. Prior to that, at age 2, I couldn't walk very well, so they would put me in a crib, and they would put the crib in a garden, and I would recite all the lyrics of all the songs in the most recent Indian movie, Bollywood movie. So they would take me to a Bollywood movie. It was like a competition. I mean, everyone was involved. The whole community actually collaborated in this child abuse. I mean, the whole community, literally, including teachers and, you know, from all over. So they would take me to a movie, a Bollywood movie, for example, and then I would sit there, and then they would take me out, put me in a garden, and I would recite the whole movie. I'd watch it once, and I would recite the whole movie. That ended abruptly at age 4. My mother had a second child, my sister, and then I was knocked off the pedestal. I think my mother had postpartum depression, which had degenerated later into psychotic disorder, I think, at the very least, possibly borderline, I'm not quite sure. And starting at age 4, for the next 12 years, I had been physically abused in life-threatening ways on a daily basis, about 8 hours a day, and psychologically and verbally horrendously abused throughout the physical proceedings. So there was like a physical torture, and I'm using the word torture judiciously. It was torture, using instruments and implements, and we'll not go into the gory details, and they were gory, it ended in blood all the time and so on. And during this, there was psychological and verbal abuse. Concurrent with this, I had a public life. I had a public life because at age 9, I was so disruptive at school. Now I realize that I had been disruptive because of my family life. The teachers didn't know what to make of me because the family life had been kept secret. I couldn't tell anyone about any of this. Only much later, my mother used to make public displays of the torture. So she would invite all the neighbors and then torture me in public, and everyone was laughing and so on. But there was at a later stage. At age 9, we still kept it a secret. I would go to school and I would go home preparing myself for the next 8 hours of torture. And so I was very disruptive. They sent me to a psychologist, and after a 9-hour test, at any rate, I finally he came to the conclusion that I had 180 IQ. Any result above 160 is largely speculative because there are not enough people to compare. So for example, my IQ, the latest test at age 35, was 190. In the whole world, there are 8 people with 190, not 8,000, 8. So they didn't know what to do with me, and finally there was a guy, Professor Aviatar. He said, you know what, there's no way you could leave this guy in primary school. You know, he's read encyclopedias, he's solving mathematical problems in tensor calculus. I mean, it's crazy to live. So bring him to the university, and that's what happened. At age 9, I was sent to the university. I started my academic studies at age 9. The problem was that, and still is, I'm very itinerant. My mind ranges so freely that I can't focus on one thing. It bores me to death. So I switch from one topic to another topic to another topic. I studied medicine, I studied physics, I studied, you know. And so I never completed any degree, although I had 8 semesters and I could have had a degree. I never completed any degree then, completed it later.
There are some questions over his credentials, a topic he's had rage attacks over, which I'll cover later.
This discovery had leaked to the press. And the press had a field day. It was like they started to compare my IQ to Einstein's IQ. Einstein had a mere 160. And Maimonides, who was the Jewish genius of all ages, and they said, Maimonides, more than Maimonides. So it was like a field day, and I became a celebrity. Definitely a celebrity in my small town. I mean, the mayor was picking me up in his car and driving me to this kind of thing, you know. And I was the MC of the ceremony of declaring my town a city. I met ministers, government ministers, and I became a media celebrity, and that lasted until age 19 or 20. Literally every day there was an article. When I say article, I mean 3-4 pages of broadsheets, you know, this kind of thing. I appeared in television, I don't know how many times. Children were chasing me in the street, asking for autographs, you know. I'm describing all this in detail because this was the public life. And then I had to go back home. I think it's the contrast that created my mental illness. My problem was that until age 4, I was a god, I was an idol. And then the same mother had tormented me for 12 years. I couldn't reconcile these two periods. I couldn't make sense of it in any way, shape, or form. So I fractured, I fragmented, I broke down. And similarly, I had a public life where I'd been utterly adulated by the high and mighty and the famous. And then I went back home and I was trashed and worse than trashed. I mean, I ended up in hospital quite a few times and so on. And I couldn't reconcile these two parts of my life as well. And this created multiple schisms and fault lines in my psyche, in my mental state, and they never healed. So I have a contradictory view of myself. On the one hand, I regard myself as trash, disposable trash, you know. And on the other hand, I hold myself to be the genius of all geniuses. It's very bad when you hold two such contradictory views of yourself. It's the stuff of multiple personality. It's the stuff of mental breakdown. It's the stuff of madness, literally. To have narcissism, you need to experience the fall from grace. You need to experience the expulsion from the Garden of Eden. I have been an inhabitant of paradise. And then my God had expelled me from paradise. For reasons unknown, I didn't even eat the apple, you know. And it is this break, this schism, which I cannot overcome and is at the source of my mental illness.
This was part of one of many lengthy interviews carried out by Mark over the months during the documentary filming. It was clear they'd established a good rapport. They banter and joke. But Sam is also seemingly being vulnerable. He had initially refused to talk about aspects of his background, but impromptu opened up about his brief stint in jail, which he claims was the catalyst for changing his ways and becoming a healer.
Would you mind sharing with us briefly, like, why you went to prison and then your, let's say, enlightenment?
It was securities fraud. One case of securities. I bought a bank. I was very rich. I had a private jet and so on. I was a vainglorious 20-something. I bought a bank, and then it was Israel's third largest bank, if I remember. And then I hyped the shares of the bank. Ironically, I owned the majority of the shares. I owned 97-something%. So it's arguable whether I deceived anyone. I think I didn't, by the way. But the price signal was skewed. I skewed the price signal. So I hyped the value of the bank via the stock exchange. And that's, of course, criminal. So I went to prison.
How many years were you in prison?
One. Having emerged from there, I decided to attempt a transformation. I decided to try to be the good guy for a change. So I became a social activist and a political activist. I also started to focus on educating victims of narcissistic abuse. I was the first educator. As I said, I coined the phrase. I gave them a language. They didn't have a language. They couldn't describe their experiences because there were no words to describe these experiences, and I gave them this language. I then helped them, actively helped them. I had the first six support groups with a total of 250,000 people at the inception of the internet. You can imagine, it's gigantic. And so these people were helped by me, and then they established their own groups, and, you know, now it's global. But ever since then, I've been acting effectively as a healer, an educator and a healer. Then I developed cult therapy and I became an effective healer. And I was healing directly with my cult therapy, which I'm doing to this very day.
Interrupting briefly, therapy. He mentions therapy and cold therapy multiple times during the documentary interviews, online and in many emails and texts between him and his supposed therapy patients. But remember what he said to me during the confrontation.
It's not private, it's your job, it's your profession.
Okay.
You're a therapist and you have vulnerable patients who come to you for help.
I'm a professor of psychology.
This is not the only time he's caught out in a lie. But for now, let's return to the interview with Mark. And I'll warn you, this part is chilling. At the time of this being recorded, he was juggling multiple victims simultaneously. I have date and time-stamped proof of this. And listen to his language, obtaining supply, lapses in multiple countries. If you know the specifics of what he's talking about, you know he's admitting all this on camera again.
I provide my own brand of therapy, cold therapy, and I have a list of clients. And so healer, educator, activist, I try to play the other side. Try to see if I can obtain supply by being the good guy. I had lapses, of course. Many. In many countries. And it's not been an easy way, but I think all in all, the good outweighs the bad. Am I as happy as I was before, you know, in my 30s or 20s? Yeah, I could say that I'm even much happier and much more content, shall we say. Up until age 35, I felt constantly depressed, constantly pressured, constantly... I felt that something was wrong, something was missing. The music, something was awry, something was... Now I don't have this feeling. I feel that everything is well coordinated and harmonious. I feel that whatever I'm doing is somehow mission-oriented, if not goal-oriented, but mission-oriented. And I feel that I am accomplishing things. I feel that I am making a difference in a variety of ways, politically, psychology, in other fields. I'm also back into physics, so My theory in physics is gaining momentum. I think it's ending well. I'm 60, so it's ending. I think it's ending well. Would I have been able to be the good guy had I not been the bad guy? I don't think so. I think the bad guy was training for being the good guy. Maybe there's a morale in there, some lesson.
It's so interesting because most people believe that someone who's a malignant narcissist, there's no hope. That's what most people believe. And many psychologists believe that as well. What was so unique about you that you, because you say you transformed from malignant narcissism to, let's say, more general narcissism. What was so unique about you that you were able to do that when most people believe it's not possible?
Nothing unique. I disagree completely that it's not possible. I think it's very common, actually. A narcissist would get supply wherever he can get it. So I'm getting supply this way now. I don't claim any preference for one way or the other. It's not that I'm morally committed to what I'm doing. It's not that I'm particularly proud of what I'm doing. It's not that I'm saying I reform myself, I'm a better person. I don't care if I'm a better person or not. I don't care what society thinks and what, you know, none of this is relevant. I found a way to obtain supply which is far more efficacious. And so now I'm sitting here. You're making a documentary. I'm participating in the documentary. It works. It's working. And since it's working, you know, I'm on it. I'm on the wagon. Stops working, we'll see. Maybe I rob banks or, I don't know, whatever it takes.
It's less risky this way, huh?
Robbing banks or participating in your documentary?
Playing this role right now is less risky, I think.
It's less risky, it's more rewarding, it's in many ways, also financially. I mean, cold therapy is, not a cheap therapy. Only very rich people can afford it, so I'm becoming rich in the process. I'm publishing books, the books are read, the books are selling. One of them is a mega bestseller, I mean, a million copies is a mega bestseller. So it's going well. Why on earth would I think of being the bad guy right now? A good guy is working. Stops working, I'll be the bad guy again. There's this conception that narcissism is rigid, not as a personality, but as a lifestyle or as a choice. It's not. Narcissism is by far the most, the narcissist is by far the most flexible animal. He's totally adaptive. He will do what it takes. He has no interest. He's not emotionally invested. He's not cathected. Cathected is emotionally invested. He's not emotionally invested in anything or anyone, any profession or any place, any language or any pet, any neighbor or any friend. There's no emotional investment in any of this. It's totally operational. If it works, we don't fix it.
Listening back to this now, knowing what he was doing, and even using his participation in the documentary to boast and silence the women, makes what he says even more sinister. I ended the last episode at the turning point, where there's about to be a dramatic shift in the dynamic and rules between Sam and Anne. And I mentioned the word love. Sam admits himself in one of the many interviews that he did with Mark that narcissists are incapable of love.
We can never hope for the narcissist to develop empathy, compassion. In other words, the interpersonal aspect of the narcissist's functioning is doomed forever. The narcissist will never be able to develop any of these, including love. He will never be able to experience love.
We'll return now to Anne's story. So her therapy was supposed to be concluded. She'd made him a celebrity in Russia. And then there was the bizarre fallout with Lydia storming off. Here's what happened next.
After that visit, he started sending me a lot of material about himself being a kid. Cutie pictures when he was a small child. Sobbing stories from his childhood. Horror stories about his mother. And it was like all the time, look at this child. Don't hurt this child. You brought me from the dead. Please don't push me back into the grave. You are my Alice in Wonderland. You have become this Alice in Wonderland. please never go away. Stay in my life in any role and capacity. And it was like every day, like every day. Then he sent me the movie Death Defying Acts about Goudini. And he wrote to me, please watch, and he gave me time code. And the main character of the movie is confessing to the woman there that she brought him from the grave, from the dead, and now he feels alive and so on, and that he loves her. And I was very, I was never attracted to Sam, never. I was attracted to Sam's mind, but I was never attracted to him as a man. I was attracted to him as the figure of authority, but never like man-woman attraction. And when I started to receive those hints from him, I felt very uncomfortable and guilty. First of all, I felt guilt that I provoked these feelings in him that I can't respond to. At the same time, I felt guilt and shame in front of Lydia, that I'm provoking, I'm doing something to provoke that, even though I knew I didn't do anything to provoke that. But if he has that feeling towards me, it means that it's my fault. I felt repelled, because when we receive those signals from men, in our brain anyway, we start to imagine this man in different settings, and I felt a feeling of being repelled. And I felt ashamed and guilty for feeling this repulsion, you know, because he saved my life, because he's my guru, because he's my everything. How can I feel this repulsion towards him? Again, it's my fault. So his confessions were like guilt, non-stop guilt-inducing syrup, you know, for me. And I started to fight myself. I started to fight myself to accept his signs of attention and to mildly respond to them in order not to offend him. But at the same time, I couldn't be firm and just tell him to fuck off, you know. I couldn't, because how? He's the great Sam Vaknin, you know.
What you were describing there, being very polite and diplomatic, which we automatically do as women, because we wouldn't want to offend or insult or be accused of being judgmental about someone's looks. This is to do with so many other things beyond attraction, but it was completely inappropriate for him to do that to you. It's very unprofessional, but as we know, this is all part of a master plan. But to go back to your point, this is someone that you were trying to be polite with, you weren't feeling those feelings, but you're almost trying to persuade yourself to feel those feelings because you're thinking, hold on a second, this is this genius. And he, you know, all the things you've explained, but I can understand why you would almost start trying to persuade yourself that that's something you should be grateful of, that he's attracted and is in love with you. And it's either you go along with that or you lose this person who has made himself like the oxygen that you need to breathe to stay alive.
Absolutely. This is exactly how I felt about him. He really became my oxygen. He became the vector around which I was revolving, because I was relying on his impeccable judgment about every single aspect of my life. Because I was thinking, who am I to make this judgment if there is this genius who can, you know, make this judgment? Of course, this is very infantile, but this is exactly what he was doing. He brings you to infantile state, because a grown-up woman would never even imagine, a grown-up mature woman would never even imagine to go through, I was going through. In order to make me do that, he would need to really reduce me to reduce me to this infantile child state. And then he would, in a sense, I call him, because when we're talking to women, you know, to other women, in a sense, he's like a pedophile, because he's abusing not the woman, he's abusing the child in that woman, you know. He's abusing this woman being a child, because the way he overcomes the mature defenses, the way he destroys the defenses, the way he destroys all the castles that are built on which we can lean on being adults, is so insane. And he touches this core, this infantile child core. And then when he's there, he does with this child core whatever he wants, because there is no grown-up woman anymore to protect this child. And in this sense, this is one of the most cruel tactics I have ever come across. When I remember I answered him something like, "I like you too a lot," or something like this, you know. And immediately I received an email from him called Adoption Papers. This email really, really, I mean, I think it was the turning point in everything, because he sent me a long email explaining to me that many things, like, you have grown very dear to me in the past year. I cannot kind of, you know, imagine my life without you, something like this. But I cannot risk losing Lydia. And I was like, where did I say that you should lose Lydia? I was actually evading all your advances. Like, but this was all in my mind. I didn't dare to confront him. So he said, "I can't risk losing Lydia, so that's why what I can offer you is to be your father. Please be my daughter. I want very much to be, let me be your father. If you let me be your father, I will tell you stories every evening. I will be there like a loving father, helping you with your decisions. You can count on me. I mean, father, be my daughter, please." So how much a grown-up 35 back then, or 34-year-old woman, should be reduced to infantile, childish state to even react, to even imagine to react to this email. Not only I reacted, I was grateful to him. I was like, wow, now definitely I will never lose him. Because you cannot throw away adopted child. And I'm his adopted daughter.
And he's desexualized it as well. Because I think his first thing of saying he loved you, your body reaction was, uh-oh, I am not attracted to him. This is, you know, of course you would have incredibly deep feelings for him because of the connection that he has created. And this is, let's be clear, this was not a friendship growing or feelings growing. It was, nothing was growing. He was grooming. All of this is grooming and creating and implanting and suggesting and normalizing and coercing. So he's now flipped it back a bit of, I'm going to adopt you, because obviously you would think, oh gosh, well, if I would be his adopted daughter, then that keeps everything clean, and you feel as a woman in our body, and any women listening to this will know exactly what we mean here. We assess everything. We assess everything. If you're meeting a new boss, for example, we immediately assess, are we safe with this person or not? And it's in the back of our mind, and it's not that we think we're immediately going to get attacked. But men in our life, in any situation, we think, hold on a sec, are we, because we need to put up a barrier, or you mention a husband, or you mention, not that that stops them, but in every situation, we do have this utterly subconscious thing assessing. So this would have put you into a state of safety again, thinking, oh, well, this is fine, because it's more of a daughter love here he's talking about. And he's appreciating the fact that he's an older man, and of course you wouldn't be attracted to him, and you have a lovely, gorgeous husband you're very happy with. But that is almost part of the fantasy as well, isn't it? It's almost an incest fantasy.
Absolutely. It's almost an incest. He's, by the way, obsessed with incest fantasies. And he's, not only I felt safe after receiving this email, like, that's it, you know, everything is settled. Now he's my father, I'm his adopted child, but I felt also at peace finally, because before I was like, well, if I don't arrange a lecture or seminar, if I don't arrange an article, if I don't promote him well enough, I will never see him again. But now, once I have become his adopted child, I will never lose him. And it was a feeling of inner peace, of... It's horrible, really.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Really, really horrible, because when I... you know...
It was the moment of security. It was a moment of... You can't... You know what I mean? That you can't... You're not going to lose him.
And what a beast you should be to abuse that. It's...
And you didn't sign any adoption papers, just so you weren't ever officially adopted, but he...
Just an email. An email called adoption papers explaining how much he wanted to be my father. So I agreed. I gladly agreed. I can even send you my answer to that email. I said, Sam, it would be... I will be very happy, of course. And the next day he continued with his flirting. And I said, look, I don't understand. You sent me an email. And he told me, could you please ignore that email? I am also very labile. You are labile because you are borderline. I am labile. I am very approach avoidant. You are very approach avoidant. But you realize who you have become for me, don't you? I said, Sam, look, I really don't understand anything anymore. Okay, we will come with Lydia again and we will talk. So they arrived with Lydia again. And again, non-stop, you know, events of lectures, seminars, clients. I mean, I was arranging lectures even in universities. I mean, insane, insane. And then after one of the events, he got me by surprise in the corridor. He took my hand and he said, listen, I'm in love with you. And I didn't respond anything. First of all, it was not reciprocated. I didn't feel love towards him. I was not in love with him, definitely. And I didn't answer anything. I just was silent. And I remember I just came back to people, to the guests. The next morning they were leaving. And he invited me for breakfast. I joined them in breakfast room, trying to pretend that nothing happened, that this, I'm in love with you, I never heard that, like nothing happened. And then Lydia stands up, she goes out to smoke. And in this moment, he grabs my hand, he takes me next to coffee machine. He puts on coffee machine, so that he says, if Lydia comes back, she doesn't hear what we are talking about. And he tells me, look, I told you something yesterday. I said, okay, so you didn't reply to me. I said, I know, I didn't reply to you. I don't know what to reply. Do you want to see me again? Or you never want to see me again in your life? If you don't answer, you will never see me again. Just tell me. I'm not going to invade your life, your space, but answer me. And there I started to have a panic attack. Because if I don't answer positively, I will never see him again. Never seeing him again means never being in touch with him again. Never being in touch with him again means new is fucked. And I said, well, yes, I'm in love with you too. I lied. He said, okay, so you're welcome to board the train of my life. I want you to become my wife. I want you to live with me. And we will come to that. Now we need to hurry to the airport. So this was the beginning of the new insane chapter. And, you know, I'm thinking, I would give a lot just never ever to have this experience in my life. Never.
I think that everyone listening can understand, having heard the background, that he's become so integral to your existence and your functioning that it would have been very difficult not to respond in that way. And before we go into the next chapter of what happened, I'd really... I know this because you and I have had some conversations off mic.
he had never, this is another technique, he went out of his way to have zero physical contact with you. It was like he almost again starved that aspect. He was so overly polite and respectful of your personal space to not touch you, that again, that was part of the technique. So when he did, it was like, whoa.
It's a very, very important thing what you're saying now, because it will have its connection further on in the story. Yes, he evaded every physical touch with me, every. For example, when we were taking pictures, it was kind of forbidden to touch him. And I remember during one of their trips to Russia, Lydia had some problems with border police. And border police wouldn't let them in. And I remember I was so nervous. And then 2 hours later, when they let them in, I met them at the airport. I ran towards them and I hugged both of them because I was so happy finally to see them. And he was like, you know, like, mind the gap, like in London subway. It was absolutely, absolutely out of question to touch him. I remember we were sitting in the balcony in some restaurant having dinner. It was very cold outside. And he had his coat with him. And I was freezing. And he saw that. And he said, take my coat. And Lydia was sitting there. Lydia said, yes, take it. It was so surrealistic to take Sam's coat, because every physical contact was excluded. We couldn't kiss when we saw each other, like, you know, like friends, cheek to cheek, yes? Maximum, he would shake my hand, and he would shake my hand like a man to man. Very tough, very, even when, I remember every time he was shaking my hand, I was anticipating pain, because all the rings I had on my fingers would, you know, be very, like, into the skin, because he was shaking my hand like a man would shake a hand of a man. And yes, you are absolutely right. So when I took this coat, I put it on, and he looked at me and he said, how do you feel to be with my coat? I said, well, it's your coat, it's something special. He said, yes, you know, like maniacs, when they put the skin of their victims, they also feel this way. And it was such an awkward pause, and then he said, Hannibal Lecter, think of me this way. Come on, it's a joke.
And he used that line of a joke many times when he would be boundary pushing.
When he says the truth, and he saw how shocked I was, it's a joke, come on, you have a bad sense of humor. But Sam is not, he wants to be Hannibal Lecter, but he's not. He's extremely afraid of blood, by the way. If he cuts his finger, God forbid, there will be, like, you know, drama. And his aim is to make woman commit suicide, to kill herself with her own hands. That's the utter elation for him. So, yeah, it's...
Which he has said in a video more than once online, and he actually has given it a name, and the name being suicide by Vaknin. Again, these things are out in the open, and this is by hiding in plain sight, by posting it, people think, well, you can't possibly, it's crazy. It's literally like a serial killer going on and describing how much they enjoy strangling people, and, you know, the people watching it thinking that they don't really do that. They're just talking about it. But he really does do everything that he explains in these videos.
I think it's important to mention Lydia's role in all of this, because Lydia, before he confessed that he was in love with me, was literally crying. Because I went to the hotel to pick them up to that lecture, and he was like, oh, I forgot my notes, I need to come back upstairs. And I was left alone with Lydia in the lobby. So she started crying, she had tears, and she hugged me. She put her head on my shoulder and she said, please take care of my genius child. He's a child, he's nothing but a child. He's so lonely. You are the first one in many, many, many years who can really bring the ray of light into his very dark existence. Please don't give up on him. Please take care. I'm not a good supply for him anymore. I remember these words about supply. I'm not a good supply for him anymore. I can't supply him anymore. So please don't give up on him. He trusts you so much. He's so vulnerable. He's so... This was just 2 hours before his confession, I'm in love with you. Then Lydia would stand up every time in a very right moment where he would need to plant the seeds about, you know, being in love with me, flirting with me, playing with his mimics, with his body language, and so on. So I do believe Lydia was an accomplice from the very beginning in all of this.
She's part of the grooming insecurity, because I think, again, that you wouldn't have agreed to go and meet him in person if she hadn't been present, because, again, you know, there was lines that had been crossed. Now, the level of her complicity or collaboration is difficult for us to work out. It could be that I have no doubt that she's been under some level of control by him. I don't know, and there are some suggestions about her own personality type with people. I've not spent enough time with her. There is definitely some level of awareness on her part that he gets to do what he wants. She maybe turns a blind eye, but she's got an assurance that he will never leave her, which is what he's clear to point out to you before there's even a suggestion of what in his mind he's trying to reframe as an affair. He's making it clear that he can't live without her. And even the scenario of you're in the middle of having a session and she got up and walked out and she said, "Oh, we'll carry on." Actually, no, I can't, because it's triggering my... And he's made himself a vulnerable little boy to you as well, that you know, even though he's this powerful genius and da-da-da, he's actually a wounded little boy, and he will absolutely know from learning everything about you, and I think many, you know, people, men and women, but especially women with our maternal instincts, would have, you know, you've got immediate sympathy for even the most awful monsters in this world. When you find out if they were abused as a child or whatever, we then have some sympathy. That is no excuse for anyone harming another person, but... That all of this is playing into what then happened.
Anne asked me to stop the recording. She had a question. Did I think the people listening would make fun of her, judge her? I understood why she asked that. Again, the self-shame and blame. A guaranteed outcome of narcissistic abuse. Hearing the narrative, it may sound like she made choices, but in Sam's own words, she had no choice. She had no ability to choose. And what comes next is not a romantic tryst. It is sexual abuse of extreme depravity, much of which I will not broadcast in detail because it's too traumatic for anyone to hear. She's physically harmed, forced to perform degrading acts, tortured with sleep deprivation. And he claims this is all part of her therapy, healing. And if she didn't comply, there were serious consequences. The little boy who was abused became the abuser. In the next episode of The Narcissist Playbook, From the Horse's Mouth, how a narcissist takes complete control.
Narcissist has a lot of power over you at some point. And then he doesn't feel the need to disguise or camouflage himself any longer. So he lets his aggression rip.
An horrific admission by Sam to one of his therapy patients.
He would tell me, you know, when you were calling me and I would have therapy sessions with you, I was all the time naked. Sometimes I was masturbating while you were crying.
And the on-ramp to the sadistic sexual abuse during the therapy sessions.
He commands for the patient to undress totally, to be totally naked during therapy session.
The Storyteller Narcissus Playbook is written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair, and it's the fourth in the Storyteller series. This is an independent production, and I rely on you, the listeners, to help spread the word by showing your support. It doesn't cost anything, just a few clicks to like, share, subscribe and review. And soon there'll be extra content available on my Patreon for the price of a cup of coffee, including analysis, evidence, regular videos and more. Thank you for listening. If you've been affected by narcissistic abuse, there are links for support in the show notes.